Hello and welcome. Quick shout out to all the newest patrons. Origins Unknown, Eric Wallers, Vet Polian, Reef, Jordan Matthews, Stephanie Westall, Jessica Edwards, Lorraine Brown, Liam Sanger, Chad, Lindsay, Tara, Kid You're Trash, Christina, and Amber Alvarez. Thank you all so much for your subscription to the Patreon. And if you're not subscribed, make sure to check it out, patreon.com/the101podcast. Exclusive content on there, over 100 episodes only available on there. And it's thanks to these beautiful people here that this is possible. Keep the lights on and we keep on rolling. If you're not a fan of the Patreon, I do have a Cash App, PayPal for a one-time donation. And if you don't like that either, we do have the Occultist Monday or the comic book, which you can purchase on my website, the101podcast.com. It's a value for value show. You can also make sure to be listening and watching the show on Rockfin, rockfin.com/the101podcast, because people on there support us. And you also get a whole bunch of other content as well for like 10 bucks a month, which is really great. Or I believe you can just subscribe to my channel. I do offer early access on there. So yeah, check it out. So thank you so much for your support. I truly, truly appreciate it. Love you all. Stay safe.
Welcome to the One-on-One Podcast with your host, Juan Ayala.
So what they do is they choose areas that have certain electromagnetic quality. They like volcanic tunnels, for instance, because the lava has sealed the outside of the wall, so the minerals, the heavy crystallized minerals, are in a circle. So they're creating vortex hyperfields just on their own. And so they choose these areas. Vulcanelli means Vulcan Canelli. Canelli is tunnel in Italian and in Latin, and Vulcan is volcano. So his name means tunnel in the volcano. So, and these places are also known for what? UFOs, strange sightings, weird places, underground cities, all this weird lore is always associated with these places because they're leak places in between the parallel plasma universe.
Welcome to the show, Jay. It's an honor to have you, sir. How you doing today?
I'm doing really good. Happy holidays to everybody.
Happy holidays to everybody. And today we have Jay Widener, obviously, on the show. And we have, as a co-host, everybody's homie Romy, who introduced me to the book. So I figured, hey, why not have him on? His knowledge is up to par with the subject at hand. And I've been studying alchemy for a little bit now, and it's been at the core of everything that I pretty much talk about. I relate alchemy to almost everything I talk about nowadays because I think life itself, existence itself, goes back to some form of alchemy, some sort of energy transference. And the thing with alchemy, it's such a multifaceted topic. It's multidimensional, it's spiritual, it's literal, it's metaphysical, whatever you want to apply it to. And this book, we're going to be talking mostly about the mysteries of the Great Cross of... It's not Hyundai, is it? You say it differently, right?
Well, it's Hyundai in French, but
Hyundai.
I like to say Hyundai because I think it was because if you know your British form of pronunciation, you drop the H at the beginning of the word. So herb is herb. Henry is Henry, right? Well, this is Hyundai, right?
End day.
End day becomes end day, which is what it's all about.
Awesome. So end day and alchemy and the end of time, which I didn't connect eschatology with alchemy, but it would make sense because we're going to be talking about Fulcanelli as well. He talks about literally part of the magnum opus is manipulating time, stepping outside of space and time to be able to manipulate it from a point of view. So it would only be appropriate to how these guys were trying to predict the end of the world, right? This double cataclysm that you talk about in the book. And how I said, I'll be honest, I started this book on audio format. Okay. I said, hey, let me listen to it. I'll take screenshots when I'm taking notes. And, you know, that way, while I'm doing something, I can be, no, I started with the audiobook. Notice that it's way too heavy, way too deep. And I had to finish on the physical copy. So, and again, these are just notes that I took on here really quickly. I was trying not to highlight the entire book because it's just so much in here. And I picked my favorite parts. A lot of the Kabbalah stuff, I'll be 100%. Sometimes, you know, when it comes to the Tree of Life, I'm not 100%. I haven't studied that too much. So, and I know it's got to do with the manipulation of reality and what all these guys were into, but Jay, can, for the people who haven't heard about you, and again, I know you've been very influential for a lot of people in the community, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you started on this topic in particular?
Yeah, I was a young man living in Hollywood being a screenwriter and, discovering that maybe I didn't want to really make films in Hollywood. I would spend my weekends roaming around looking, going to book garage sales, looking for books. I'm a book collector. I have thousands of books. And one day I walked into a place in the Valley, San Fernando Valley. It was a garage sale. And there was probably 70 books. I had 20 bucks on me. They were a buck each. And they were some of the most phenomenal. I still have all of them, of occult secret knowledge books ever published. And apparently the lady that was running the garage sale didn't even know what her husband was doing. And so she was putting these books up for $1, just the Mystery of the Cathedrals hardcover at that time was worth $600. And this was in 1986. All right.
Oh my. So, wow. Yeah. Hardback. Oh,
all these books were worth $1,000 at the time. Now they're worth $50,000. I got them for 20 bucks. I had 20 bucks on me. I bought 20 books, went home, perused most of the books. But then I came upon Mystery of the Cathedrals. And, you know, I really considered myself a smart person. I wrote to a lot of people. I had ongoing letter campaigns with people that were, you know, highly intelligent people. And I was only in my 30s, but I was, you know, writing higher than I should have been, I guess. And I always picked in my life, I've always picked older people to hang with. So when I was 20, I hung with 30-year-olds. When I was 30, I hung with 40-year-olds all the way up. Now I'm in my, going to be close to 70, and I'm hanging out with 85-year-olds. And so I read the book and I think I threw it against the wall like five times. I read it, I go against the wall, and then I said, "Let's go out to dinner. I need a drink, you know, and or whatever." Because that was how it went. And then all the time I'm in dinner, all I'm thinking about is that friggin' book that's back there against, you know, on the floor that I threw against the wall, you know, and trying to entertain the lady, and all I can think about is getting back there. And I get back there, I immediately go back into the book, and I'm like, okay, this doesn't make any sense. I cannot understand what this book is about. And so then I said I was going to understand it. And I did. And I realized at one point that all of the italicized words needed to be investigated. There's strange italicized words all through the copy of the text. And so this is way before internet. I went to the Seattle Public Library every day at 9 o'clock when it would open. I'd stay up there till about 5-6 o'clock at night, investigating every single italicized thing. So I ended up learning about the Cathars and about just every kind of incredible esoteric knowledge that I could ever learn, not really understanding why I'm even doing all of this, except that I'm trying to understand this unfathomable book. And then I slowly started learning the lingo and the language and what was really going on and what was actually really being said. And of course, then this was expanding me out to learning about, you know, the electric universe and plasma physics and, you know, and trying to put it all together into this thing until I came to the conclusion that history and time itself is an alchemical experiment, and that there is an end to that experiment. And that experiment in alchemy is the transmutation of base metals into finer metals, or base material into light, gold and light. And I think that we are at the very crux of that point in time right now. I think that that the sun has gone from gold to white in the last 20 years. That's seriously important, because the sun represents the, you know, the alchemical presence. And the fact that it's changing color should really concern us. And and the events on the ground, of course, around us are rising up of dark forces that seek to make sure that we cannot achieve enlightenment. And as we, because of the internet, really, as we move towards this mass collective awakening, which is definitely going on, which is predicted by the great alchemical experiment for alchemical Earth, you're going to see this ramp up of wow, one revelation after another, with the counter, which is really growing and is angry and is terrified. And and to this day, all I can say is I don't know what they're terrified of, except that it must be us figuring everything out, and they don't want that. And so as we begin to figure everything out and realize that we are great enlightened beings who come from a great, incredible past of a race of people that were incredible, that could build and do almost anything. And we have just the remnants of that race around us. But even those remnants tell us that there is, that what this race was impossible, at least for us. It's not dynastic Egypt that you need to look at, it's pre-dynastic Egypt. It's not Inca Peru remnants that you need to look at, it's pre-Inca Peru remnants you need to look at, because those can't be explained. Those are not, it's impossible. It's impossible what they did. It's, you know, it's one thing for the dynastic Egyptians to build pillars by cutting like hamburger slices and then putting them on top of each other with levees. But the pre-dynastic ones, they would cut the dang thing completely out of the granite, 100 feet tall obelisk, completely cut out of granite, and move 500 miles south without breaking over and over and over and over again. And there, this cannot be... how this happened cannot be answered by conventional understandings of what is going on, but it can be by alchemy. And alchemy is the concentration of etheric energy into either the body or into a piece of metal or into a building, or into a chemical, or into food, or into water. It's into everything. You can raise animals in an alchemical way. I do. All right. So it's not. It's an all thing. It's the science of the ancients that we lost, and it would appear from my position that a very sinister force moved in and is bound and determined to keep us ignorant, and that they are the ones that are after all of the people who are seeking this kind of knowledge. And they've been after us for thousands of years.
So we know that according to mainstream history, alchemy originated in Egypt, right? That's what they say. Do you think this is a lost science of the ancients? So they might have gotten it from this pre-Egyptian civilization. So this idea of being able to, how I said, and how you're saying there are forces at work at the moment to stop us from homo luminous, is what you call it in the book, this enlightened light being. And it reminds me of the Taoist monks with the with internal alchemy and that light body, that homunculus, the one where they, as you know, you turn the energy in on itself and you're able to, you know, congeal and crystallize a small little man within you. And you're saying that's what they're stopping us from. I mean, if you look at Hollywood with all the movies that they're putting out, social media, all these conglomerates, what they put in our foods, they're stopping us because they know it's inevitable that this is going to happen and we're going to achieve this magnum opus as a whole. Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, the thing is that because I've kind of been there through the whole thing over the last 30 years, as I realize, and others, very good people that are friends of mine, we all kind of realize, you know, we're boomers, we're going to die soon, so we're not afraid anymore. And but 30 years ago, when we all started, it was like it was a different world. We could say things that we can't say now. And we could speculate about things that we can't speculate on now without getting in a lot of trouble. And so we've seen, as we got more and more looser with what we were giving out and saying, I see the obvious dark forces rising up. The more that we did it, the more the dark forces rose up until it became, you know, I'm involved in a $5 million lawsuit right now, right? Because the dark forces want me squashed. I'm not even political. I mean, I talk about the dark forces, but not in a way like we need to rise up and destroy them. I don't get into that stuff. I'm not into that because I know that actually the way to not defeat them, but stop them, is through the homo luminous and the alchemical enlightenment of humanity. And so that is the route I'm going down, and that drives them crazy because the YouTube algorithms can't figure out what the hell I'm talking about on my show. And so I'm staying like out of the fray, right? And so we're on that place now where we can either go towards this technocratic future of chips and everybody tied into the centralized system, which I do not believe is going to happen. In fact, I know it will not happen. We as humans live for the fight. It's not the victory that you seek. It's the fight itself. It's just like the hunt is the only really fun part. The kill is not actually very much fun. It's the hunt that is fun. The fight is what we're in now. And the fight is a spiritual war between us and forces that are far more darker than I ever imagined. And every day it becomes more and more apparent that this force seeks to completely press itself down onto us. The current spending bill that they're arguing right now. My God, if you didn't know, if you were an atheist and you didn't believe there was a Satan, all you got to do is read that bill. See, this bill, if I was Satan, I would write this bill. You know what I mean? So that's the point we're at now. And the destruction of this realm, which is what the Hendaye Cross talks about, is, and this is what Vincent and I kept coming up against in our research back 25 years ago, was we would read Vedic texts, we'd read the alchemical texts, we'd read all these texts about anything that had to do with eschatology, right? And it always ended up that the end of the world was a good thing. It was this really super positive thing for the human race, and it had nothing to do with, you know, the everybody dying in a giant fire or whatever. So, you know, that itself was the INRI, right? In fire, nature is renewed. And so we know that what this world is right now, it's not sustainable and it can't go on. You can't, there isn't enough cobalt to build enough batteries for electric cars. There's people are, we've lost our collective mind. We don't understand what's going on. That future that they're promising us, the WEF people and all those guys, that's not going to happen. That's never going to happen. There's not, it's a fantasy run by the new class of the manager system who appear to be anti us. That's all.
Oh, it's the transmutation of a fictional reality into our actual reality. So my whole thing is, if they're against, but why is it, Jay, that they're against us finding about these arts and using these things? Is on my show, I talk about these things in order to unveil it. Right, that's what the apocalypse is, the unveiling, to talk to people about it, to bring awareness to it. Now, why is it that they try and stop us from discovering this, but yet they use these same tricks against us almost as if it does actually work? What are your thoughts on that? Because if you look at Hollywood, government, and all these things, they're using alchemy real time with their symbolism, with their words, with everything that they do, and any exchange of money is alchemy. And the if you follow, you know, like Tracy Twyman wrote about, if you follow the foundation of the monetary system that we have today, it has alchemical roots. So
I agree. I just want to say quickly, Tracy told me about 6 months before she passed away that, Jay, I will never commit suicide. Just saying.
Oh, we know 100%. We know what happened there. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to, you know, we know exactly what happened there. Yep. So I call it flying too close to the sun. And and usually what I've seen with people in the community who speak, any, if you look at history, you see that the people who usually were telling something that went against the mainstream, those were usually the ones that ended up dead. Those are the ones that were killed off.
That's right. That's what the whole Christian mythos is really about, is this guy coming and telling people stuff they don't want to hear, and then they crucify his ass, which is also alchemy, by the way. When I was raised a Catholic, but I rejected the religion early on. But later, you know, like maybe 15 years ago, I reread the New Testament, and it's actually quite an alchemical testimony, really. It's all about the speaking truth to power and then having power destroy you. And then you, through alchemical methods, you are resurrected to defeat those powers. And, you know, whether that story is true, it doesn't really matter. That is an alchemical process. And it is about your body as a crystal or a Christ being reborn into light. And so, in a way, Christianity is the most alchemical of all religions. Although, some esoteric Judaism gets close, only because it retains the Egyptian messages that that somehow got into the Hebraic text. In other words, the tree of life and the geometry of existence and sacred geometry that somehow managed to go from Egypt into the Canaanites or the Phoenicians, who I believe are the ones that we should be talking about as far as the alchemical purveyors of knowledge on the planet. I would say it was probably the Phoenicians, who lived in Israel and Lebanon area and were extremely influential throughout the world. I believe that they are the ones who somehow found the original alchemical texts and translated them, and then went out into the world with their ships to see if what these texts were saying was friggin' true, and it was. And these are the Pura Reis maps comes from, where South America and Antarctica are clearly delineated before there was an ice age. And people like Graham Hancock know all this. He is a great show. Ancient Apocalypse is all about this. He doesn't know any of this, though. He doesn't know alchemy. But he's a good journalist, and he discovered mm-hmm. it. So yeah, the Cross of Hende is a monument by a secret society of advanced people. And it was there to tell us about the past event of a gigantic double catastrophe, which I no longer believe the double catastrophe as described in the book, by the way, because of new research. So I believe that the double mm-hmm. catastrophe is probably more akin to a marriage between Graham Hancock's comet theory and Robert Schoch's solar flash ending the Younger Dryas theory. They're both the same. So the double, and it's clearly shown on the sun face of the Cross of Hende. So you have four objects in the corners and then the angry sun. And the four objects, I believe, are the comet that came 13,000 years ago, broke into four pieces.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of pieces hit Canada and North America, causing the Younger Dryas. And for 1400 years, we were thrown into the coldest period.
Getting some feedback. Ever. Is that me on my end? I'm sorry.
No, I don't know.
That sounds good over here.
Let me turn down a little bit. Okay. Hang on. So, and then I believe that first the comets came, crashed into the earth, caused like a nuclear winter, created the Younger Dryas, 1400 years, the biggest cold that ever happened occurred, hundreds of thousands of species disappeared, and then the solar flare came, melted the ice that had built up over the Younger Dryas almost overnight, maybe 2 weeks. Everything came flooding through, the floods up in Washington State. The Sahara Desert appears to have had gigantic floods. It's as if this huge ice buildup happened, and then wham, it came down, and literally the oceans rose 400 feet. And that happened about 11,500 years ago. And that's a double catastrophe. It was the most trying event in human and probably historically for the mammalian life forms on Earth. It was horrifying.
Do you think that through the process that we see as the transition and the evolution of religions over the centurion, right? From ancient Egypt and pre-dynastic Egypt, you know, speaking of religion in an alchemical sense, that each time that religious syncretism takes place, it almost each time that a religion sits upon another and absorbs its energy, almost like the passing of the stone of destiny or something along those lines, to absorb that religion. Do you think that's an alchemical process that is almost what the powers that be have been really trying to like tote around to make something new each time that religious syncretism takes place? And if so, we found ourselves in such a transmutative muck in modernity through this crazy alchemical process and history of these higher echelons of power.
Yeah, I think that the powers that be have a lot of control over religion. I'm pretty sure that the same group that, you know, Mecca, where Muhammad was a big, huge outpost of the powers that be, as was Jerusalem around Jesus's time. And I think that the actual religion itself is grassroots. But as it rises up and gains popularity, then they come down and they change, as we know the Romans did to Christianity. Mm-hmm. They rearranged mm-hmm. everything and made it look like the Jews had committed deicide, and therefore they could go in and conquer Jerusalem, because that was a big problem for the Romans at the time. And but I think that there is this alchemical underpinning to religion and to spiritual thought that is free of the powers that be. And that's what drives them crazy. Because
yes.
you go down, like, how is the powers that be going to stop me from saying that I have a, that I have a light body, that it centers down my spine, and that this light body I can make as big as I want it, or I can shrink it in as much as I want it, because I have control over this. And this light body can become so strong that it can influence nature and animals and people all around me if I so desire. Now, they can't stop me from saying that because they probably don't quite understand what I'm saying, but if everybody understood what I was saying, then they would be defeated, because all you have to do is just expand our light body and blow them out of the water. So they've created what I call light body constriction areas, which are called cities. Ooh. And so when you're in the city, you don't want your light body to be commiserating with possibly a criminal that's 15 feet away from you, and you know, somebody who's a crack whore over here, and whatever, right? You don't want your life, so you constrict it. You're in the city and you're like, I can feel yeah. it. When I live in the country where I can let my light body go out, but when I go to the city, I can feel definitely myself constricting my light body. And so, you know, especially in elevators and real tight places. And so if you live in a city, you're going to have a big problem with doing this. So you have to go out of your way to create practices and disciplines that allow you to expand your light body. So different areas have different problems, right? If you live in the Great Plains, you're not around many minerals or mountains or anything. So you've got that kind of problem. So you have to rectify that. So alchemy is about, you know, your location, how much you understand the place around you. And religion is, and spirituality is, the grassroots, original grassroots concept of all of this, of which now we're beginning to lose, they hope, but that's not going to happen. So one of the ways that they control us is through fear of death. And, you know, everything, the movies and everything, right? Everybody's going to die. It's all the end of the world and all that. But in alchemy, we know that we're just electrical fields, you know, nested within each other. So my body is an electrical field nested within the field of my house and my family. And then there's another field of my community, and then my country, and then the world, and then the universe. And it's a series of nested infinities, you might say. And so I know that when I die, and I will, I know that when I die, that my field, no matter how strong it is going to start collapsing in on me. As I get sick, or I'm in a car accident, or somebody shoots me, or whatever, right? Freezing to death. And as it constricts, it comes down to the skin level. That is when you start getting cold, by the way, because your light body is heating you. It's not giving you a lot of heat, but it is giving you heat. And I can explain that from nature very clearly. In other words, there's animals in nature that have no body fat, that can live in 30 below degree weather and not die and not have any food or anything, because they're living off their light body. coyotes, buffalo. I can show you, go to Yellowstone in the middle of the winter, and I can show you these animals. I can show you coyotes that weigh 25 pounds, full-grown coyotes that are shrunk down to 25 pounds, completely fine. And by spring, they're going to be up to 150 pounds, all right? Because they're living alchemically. They're by reducing the food supply and being in the cold increases the electrical current that goes on, and the animal lives off that current, which you can also live off of, your own current. But as you die and that light body begins to pass underneath the level of the skin, you'll get really cold. That's a sign that you're going. That's a sign that, you know, you haven't got long to go. So at that point, you make good with your loved ones and everything, because you've got maybe 10, 15 minutes to go. As the light body finally constricts down, it grabs a hold of the spinal column and lights it up and shoots upward right through a filament that connects to the larger plasma body called the Sushumna in Hindu Vedic terminology. This is a millionth of the size of a human hair. And it shoots up. That's the tunnel that you see when you die. And you go back into the larger plasma nested fields to determine what you're going to be and what you're going to do next. Are you going to come back? Are you going to go to the next level? Did you spend your time wisely here in this existence? That's like the super most important question that's going to be asked of you when you pass into the next realm is, what did you do? Did you spend your time masturbating and watching the Lakers? Or were you actually doing something with your life? Were you helping people? Helping yourself? Were you working every day to try to make yourself better, more honest, you know, in a fearless manner with the world? And this is the path of the wizard and the alchemist. And so there's nothing to be afraid of. Really the only fear is what you have to fear. I'm sure if you saw a mountain lion on the path, you would be very afraid, and you should be, and you should react as a person filled with fear, because you don't want to lose your life in a gory way. But as far as the final ending of this reality, there's no ending. It's fire. Nature is renewed. You are always renewing yourself. Mm-hmm. You are a eternal spirit that has somehow been graced with a body so that you can eat and touch and fuck and all the great things that exist in this world. And you're, one day you're going to go. When you go, you're going to take all of that with you. And it becomes part of the electrical etheric record, the Akashic record. And that is what alchemy is. Alchemy is this understanding of this larger field. And so what alchemists try to do is they try to take this etheric world, this etheric force that's all around us, and concentrate it. That's it. They try to concentrate it in their tantien. They try to concentrate it in metal. I have a chunk of gold that I concentrate these energies into, and then I flake some of it off every once in a while, and I drink it in water.
Jay, and, can I ask you, are you an alchemist?
We're all alchemists.
A practicing alchemist?
Of course.
Nice.
Of course, I'm a practicing alchemist. My morning drink takes almost a half hour to make, you know? And it probably costs, I don't know, $10 a glass for an 8-ounce glass, at least, maybe 15. I haven't really ever done the math on it. But, you know, I buy ingredients from all over the world that I've investigated and looked at. And someday I'm going to make a video about that, and so people can understand how to alchemize your life. Mm-hmm. You know, I go out in the sun all the time. I don't use sunscreen. I think it's insane to be afraid of the sun. The sun is our greatest friend. I'm with Cliff High, you know, sun your balls, I think he calls it. You know, go outside, nice. Take your friggin' clothes off, right? And get that sun all over you. Don't be afraid. Don't listen to those idiots that tell you that you're supposed to be afraid of the sun, right? You're not supposed to be afraid. You get out, get some fresh air, and eat organic food. And if you eat meat, which I do, you know, make friends with the animals that you're going to eat. I know it sounds weird, but do have a great relationship with them. I do. And they love me and they want to be part of me. And that's alchemy too. And so alchemy is everything. And we can, once you understand how powerful and strong you are, then you can start going into other parallel universes that are around us. And then you pick up more information from the beings and inhabitants of those universes. So, you know, the funny thing about all this is when I first found that book, Mystery of the Cathedrals, I would have believed that I would one day be saying all this crazy shit.
But, Jay, so do you think, because you're talking about Falconelli, do you think that Falconelli could have been this, the Elias Artista, the ascended master that he was? Because another thing about alchemy is during the magnum opus, you become this androgynous being. And we do have accounts of Falconelli appearing as, I call him the cross-dresser, but as a woman as well. And I think that's the funniest part. Do you think he was like this Elias Artista, Saint Germain character, that he was outside of the fabric of reality and would just troll people? Because he was a troll. Right. And we can get that out of the way. He was a troll.
He was a troll. And his whole purpose was to prove to you that although he wasn't going to give you the secret of alchemy, he was going to prove to you that alchemy was true and real. That was his purpose. And so what he did was he did a mind fuck on you, where, you know, he would take only the most intelligent people could read the book. So nobody's reading that book without having like a pretty heady background in reading. So he's only appealing to the very top 2%, 3% of intelligence. And he's challenging them from the beginning, like saying, you don't know crap. You don't know anything. You think you know everything. You don't know anything. And so you get pissed off. And that's the whole point of trolling. That's what trolls do, right? They piss you off. So then you get suckered in by the troll job. And then pretty soon you're in there and then you're like going, holy crap, this is all real. And everything I thought I knew was completely wrong. And then you get embarrassed. You go through that whole part of your existence where, you know, now you got to go around and tell everybody that all that arrogant crap that I was feeding you was all wrong. And now I'm, you know, super humble and, you know, and that's hard to do too, especially when you're arrogant like I was. And, but you know, it was a humbling experience. And so, yes, I think that Falconelli's whole purpose was to take a certain kind of individual and transform them, to initiate them. It was like, okay, all the masters are gone. He implies it over and over in the book that all the great masters are gone. They've all gone off to wherever they go to. And so he left this book behind. And it was a committee. I don't think Falconelli was one guy. I think it was maybe 10 or 11 people. Schwaller de Lubitsch, Champagne. It was a bunch of people that were involved in it. And it was designed to initiate you into this thing. And, you know, all through this investigation, I kept coming across weird stories. And one of the weird stories that I heard was that Schwaller de Lubitsch, the great French Egyptologist, that he had a school in Switzerland called the School of Light, something de luxe. I can't remember what it was called. And one night, a strange olive-skinned, dark-haired guy shows up and wants to talk to Schwaller. And they spend all night alone in a room talking. And this is Schwaller's wife that tells the story. And then the next morning, Schwaller's all excited. This guy, whoever he is, he leaves. We don't even know who he is. I think his name was Muhammad. And he and Schwaller says, we got to go to Egypt. I've got stuff there I've got to look at, right? So he immediately goes to Egypt, goes to the Temple of Luxor, writes the Temple of Man, the whole thing of Schwaller. But what he let out later to his wife was that this guy was a Sufi, some kind of odd sect of Sufi masters who were dedicated to transforming the human race, and they had to keep quiet to stay away from, I don't know, what do you call it, the cabal, whatever. And and so if you go through alchemical literature over and over, you'll find these strange incidences very much like that, where someone is just minding their own business, and then all of a sudden this olive-skinned individual shows up and does something.
A green man.
And then they go off on a tangent completely opposite of what they were doing. And this happens all through. And Fulcanelli intimates that it's a group of Sufis that are at the center of this, and that they are determined to let the righteous rule the earth, is what they say. And the righteous are the ones that understand alchemy and the science of light.
Sufism also is incredibly mystic, and I love Sufism. I love Idris Shah, who is one of probably the most prolific Sufic writers, and I love his style of writing. It's beautiful. And then he intertwines like white and black magic into his writings just elegantly. Yes. The Sufis, I really do feel like, are some of the last mystics that have the understanding of how to utilize this old technology that was the architecture that Fulcanelli describes. Yeah. Because the whirling dervishes are in the basements, they're spinning, they're chanting, they're resonating, and they're moving. And I feel like a lot of the magic that we are able to tap into with our awesome vessels and bodies is through creating like friction, whether that's like a cosmic or a conscious friction by like looking at something, creating a conscious friction, or rubbing stones up and getting the stones to be hot and warm. And so I love Sufis. I love, and there's so much there. It's Sophie, it's Gnostic, it's wisdom.
Yeah, and when they dance, they tilt their body. And if you actually do a measurement, it's 23 and a half degrees, which is the tilt of the earth. So it's like, wait, what's going on here?
Whoa.
And and their name is Sufi. It's got all sorts of different connotations. And, the original story of the Sufis was that they were out doing their whirling dervishes practices around a campfire or something. And Muhammad and 800 guys show up with swords, and they walk up to the leader and they stick the sword up to his neck and say, do you believe in Allah? And the Sufi guy goes, well, what's Allah? And he says, well, Allah's the creator of the universe. He says, of course we believe in Allah. And then it didn't matter whether they were actually Muslim or not. They were immediately accepted in because they were smart enough and astute enough to know that the central core thesis of the Islamic religion was completely and utterly correct, and which is also an Islamic religion is also an alchemical religion, as the mosques are extremely alchemical and are concentrations of etheric power, even though, again, it's like some evil force came in and just stripped the dogma out and ruined it, and just like they did with Christianity. So there's no more, unless you understand alchemy, you can't understand what the story of Jesus is about. And if you don't understand alchemy, you can't understand what Islam is about. So it's like,
but they have this exoteric stuff that they put out there. So they'll put these writings out for you to intake without knowing what they mean. They teach us mathematics, but they don't teach us what the cipher, what the symbols, what the sigils mean. You know what I'm saying? So they put us in front of all these things, but they don't teach us exactly what it means. And I was raised Pentecostal Christian, and how when you talk about the, let's look at the King James version, right? Let's talk about alchemy. We can trace back a lineage to guys in secret societies who were masters of ciphers, and they're at the core of the spread of one of the largest I call it interdimensional literature, where these stories, these books, quite literally have shaped humanity over hundreds and thousands of years, because it's a story. It's what it is. Now, some people will eat, live, breathe this story. And if you look at King James, I mean, that's a shady character on his own, plus the connection with Bacon, and you have the connection with Shakespeare and all these guys. I mean,
say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
El app del clima dice que va a llover. El app de McDonald's que toca McDelivery. Ordena McDelivery en el app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
I mean, they were messing. They knew exactly what they were doing. And if you look at Shakespeare and his influence on the English language, which I think at the core of language, the original alphabet only had 17 or 19 letters, and they've added things that have never existed in order to demystify us, because grammar comes from grimoire. I mean, we know this is etymology.
I'll beg to differ though, sir, because I think that the language itself has been curated to be specifically alchemical, to kind of bring all these other magical workings and then make, I personally, and you know this because we have the article Occultus Mundi, that I'm focusing on the history of the cipher of the modern American alphabet, that itself is incredibly alchemical, and it's a cipher.
For the initiated, for the adepts.
Exactly.
So, if you're not in the club, then you're fucked.
Yeah, so Bacon ran the committee that wrote Shakespeare. And he was an alchemist. And you're right. It was all done to inculcate English as an alchemical language. maybe not done for exactly great purposes, but done nonetheless. So John Dee was an alchemist, and he was probably the inspiration behind Shakespeare, in that he told Francis Bacon that he wanted you to, why don't you create a committee, and we're going to write these plays that are going to be alchemical knowledge that we're going to inculcate into the masses, and then we're going to make English the world language. An alchemical world language. And so Shakespeare, and if you go to Psalm 40, so in this alchemical lineage, there's 33 levels, right? But there's 13 levels above that, for a total of 46 levels. So there's the pyramid has 33 levels. And that's what everyone thinks is the top. But there's 13 more levels for a total of 46. Is that like what would be the capstone? 13 guys run the bottom pyramid, okay? So Francis Bacon was a 46-degree Freemason. He ran the very top dude. If you go to Psalm 46 in the King James Bible and you count 46 words from the beginning, you get the word shake. And if you count 46 words from the end, you get the word spear. Okay, that's a direct codified language telling you that Shakespeare is giving you 46 degree knowledge inside those plays and inside that language. So Shakespeare himself, the language has to be looked at in a different way. So this was done as an alchemical attempt to change the world. That's just Francis Bacon's writings about America and
New Atlantis
and all of this. You can see it all. It's really, really easy. And the Cross of Hende comes out about the same time, right? So you got to figure that's part of it too, right? And Nostradamus is out about this same time. So we've got this milieu going in the United States and in England and in France and Italy with the Da Vinci. And so they're all reaching this gigantic understanding of what the process is, and like Leonardo's putting it in his paintings and Shakespeare's putting it in his writings and everything. And then it gets upended. Then the whole thing, whether you like it or not, it gets upended in 1666 with the Great Fire of London. And so in 1666, so in 1665, Lord, I'm going to forget his name, the first Prime Minister of England. I always forget this guy's name because I hate his guts so much. I can't remember his name. It'll come to me. He was the first. They overthrew the king in the English Civil
Walpole?
War.
Sir Robert Walpole?
No. Begins with the B.
That's Britain's first. This is the chronology. So I'm
anyway,
trying to look
he
here.
He outlawed Catholicism in the British Empire. So that's where Mary, Queen of Scots and all that came from. So he outlaws mm-hmm. Catholicism, and then they go out and they actually kill Catholics. They go to England, Ireland and kill all the Irish because they're all Catholics. And they go to Scotland and kill all the Scottish that are Catholics. And anyway, so he decides to, let the enemy in the gate. I'm not going to go any further than that because I don't want you guys to get censored. But in 1665, he decides to let the enemy in the gate. So the enemy comes in the gate, and the enemy is a bunch of bankers. And the bankers realize that the safest place in Europe to put a bank for money is London. Because you got to go down the Thames River, and you can put a gauntlets up and destroy anyone coming down the river. And you can put all your money into the banks there in England. So magically, a year after the enemy gets in the gate is the Great Fire of London, 1666, in which the place that we now call the City of London, which is a separate entity from London and England, was completely burned out to the ground. And then
get to building.
In 3 years, it's all rebuilt and it's a whole banking community. And what they did was they recognized what England and Bacon, Shakespeare, John Dee, they recognized what they were doing, which was they're trying to create a worldwide alchemical civilization. And they came in and they usurped it. And they created the East India Trading Company. And they used their theater that they'd learned from Shakespeare and from Francis Bacon to create events, fake events everywhere around the world to conquer the world. And that's what happened. And that's the so every time that we try to make the world into a better place, this weird force comes in and destroys it, which is the Tower of Babylon or Babel story. That's what that story is about. It's about all the people coming together to build, unify a town, and then boom, comes disaster, chaos, and everything is dispersed into chaos, which is what happened. And right now, we're at the end of that process, and the entire edifice that was built by those people is now falling apart and crumbling.
That's interesting. You could have the faction set up that the alchemical workers, the philosophers, the people that were of these of the people basically wanted to create an alchemical society like Francis Bacon and John Dee. Those were separate entities then of the bankers and those different echelons, and they were in cahoots together
until 1665. It was long after 60 years after. After all,
they put in so much work too. They put in so much work. You know what's interesting about 1666 and like those kind of like magical dates? Like 1888 was the year that Madame Blavatsky put out her great magnum opus as well. And then you start to see a shift, which is convenient timing too when you look at the Folconelli timeline, because right up into the World Wars and the Great Depression, there was a huge occult like knowledge just swathing over the lands. And then now we have a desecration of all of that through these wars. Do you think that the wars themselves are a part of that banking faction that was coming in? And because they saw the same shit going on from people like Blavatsky's and the Theosophical Society?
Absolutely. I think that it's still going on. And so every time that we, so Europe is going through this gigantic, how do I put it? Non-Christian alchemical renaissance, where they're getting all the ancient books and everybody's passing them around, and this is going on, and there's this big buildup, and then boom, World War One hits, right? And everybody's cast into chaos and everything is dispersed into nothingness. And then everybody regroups in Paris after the war. So 1920, the great Paris, Renaissance, where everybody pours into Paris, including Fulcanelli and all the alchemists, and Fulcanelli's book emerges out of this milieu. And then this gigantic, huge renaissance of alchemy starts up. By 1930, it's just like, whoa, it's going in America and England and France and Italy, and everybody's like super into it, and books are being written. And, I have them. They're gone now, but there were amazing books exploring ancient ruins and what they mean in America. And it was amazing. And then, boom, 1938, crash down. And out of this, I call this Project X, because I believe this whole project is being financed by somebody, this whole alchemical project. Okay. So the Germans, I don't want to use the word that everybody calls because you'll get censored, but the Germans of the 30s and 40s, the certain group within, the word has two S's in it, there's a group within that group. And that group was, sent out and financed to investigate Fulcanelli, the ruins in the mountains of the Andes, the Mayans, the Tibetans, everywhere. They went everywhere. They went all over the world. And that was financed by the Germans, because Hitler himself was obsessed with trying to find the alchemical secret. I know this is shocking, but the very first thing that Hitler did when he arrived in Hende, France in 1938, or 1940, was he went straight up the hill from the train station right to the cross. It's like 500 yards, maybe. No, 1,000 yards. So right up the hill, he went right to the cross where he supposedly met somebody and they had a long conversation, okay? So I'll be very careful here. But it is very possible that what we think was going on in 1930s, 40s, in a certain place in Europe, may not be what we think it is, because the same exact forces came in just like they did before and destroyed it. And
it was an occult war. It was a war for occult powers. We can say that. Obviously, we know that history has been obscured, and maybe it. And I'm not denying anything.
No,
but we have to take into consideration all the possibilities. Okay. I'm just going to say that, but I'm sorry, continue.
And we know that, early on, when those particular people actually took power, like in 1938 they made a specific request to study, non-establishment science that went out from the very top to the scientific community of that country to study non-establishment views. And so all of these theories started rising up that were pretty amazing, including how the ancient Vedics powered their flying craft, their Vimana, and all sorts of stuff about, mercury as an alchemical product. And so I'm not defending anybody. I'm not defending somebody who did terrible things that they did. I'm just saying that it's just curious that every time that it looks like somebody's actually spending the money and investing in looking into this, that the same exact group comes in to upend the whole thing. And then, you know, right now on the internet, there's this big explosion of Tartaria, which is a great thing. Mm-hmm. I love it. But people going back and looking at all these buildings, these photographs of buildings that don't exist anymore. And they're saying, you know, what are these? What's going on here? How come nobody explains this stuff to us? And clearly the buildings are alchemical vessels designed to bring down etheric energies into the...
Jay.
Yep.
You're touching on something I want to touch on before we wrap up.
Right.
But architecture, because I'm real big into Pythagorean palaces, and I do believe that anything can be used as a talisman that can be charged, including the architecture. We have the Gothic cathedrals, which I didn't put two and two together, but the idea that the Knights Templar, through the use of alchemy, were able to fund the building of these great cathedrals, and not only that, but how you're architect as magician, where who were building these cathedrals? John Dee talked about architecture as being one of the greatest art forms. You needed to know the quadrivium and understand everything as a whole. So can we talk a little bit about these the architecture? You have Vitruvius talking about how certain spaces are used for certain things. You brought up the cities concept, where they're trying to block our light body from being able to expand. They're also going to be implementing 15-minute cities. And if you know anything about Francis Yates and the art of memory, the idea of using models. And one thing that I learned recently was, because when you build a mind palace, right, you envision the palace and you line up the walls with all the trinkets and all this cool stuff. But I didn't know the psychic aspect of it, to where if you have a model of this building and you tap into the energy of this simulacra of the actual thing, that you're able to see the thoughts and influence people's ideas and extract ideas from people in the real building through the use of some sympathetic magical thing. So can we talk about the architecture and how these cathedrals could have kickstarted a literal transmutation of the ages, from the Iron Age to the Golden Age, the Enlightenment. Can we talk about that, please?
You know, I'm loving this because you're forcing me into showing you once again when an attempt at an alchemical transformation of society was tried and mostly succeeded. Okay, which was the building of the 500 more Gothic cathedrals all through Europe in the years from 1100 to 1400.
During who funded that? Period.
There was a great warming period in Europe where you could grow grapes in Scotland, and it was this amazing period. And this the Templars had returned with their alchemical knowledge from Jerusalem, and they started this building process. The church itself never claimed that it was part of it. They weren't Christian edifices. Fulcanelli is clearly obvious about that. Although, like we were talking about, Christianity has an alchemical origin, so in that way they are Christian, but mostly Egyptian. They're using the sacred geometry and things. And what that did was, the church had been repressing Europe heavily up until 1000. You couldn't read, you couldn't write, you couldn't do math. Everything was outlawed. All you could do is work your field, give your stuff over to the duke who ran the feudal system, and then the church would get a little bit of largesse. So suddenly, with the building of the cathedral, you had to learn how to communicate, read, write, math, geometry, especially geometry. All these things became paramount importance. So suddenly schools were started teaching these things to mostly males, who then went out and built these cathedrals. So it was an attempt by the alchemical Templars to transform Europe, which it did. In fact, there would not have been a Reformation or a Renaissance without even... mainstream historians say this, without the building of the Gothic cathedrals, which transformed Europe into, again, almost did it until forces came in and overthrew, and, the Templars were overthrown by again, these evil forces that keep coming up. And, you know, so what can I say? You know, we have a theme in this show of the alchemical renaissance being destroyed by the same damn dark force. I mean, it's like we're in the same families almost, you know?
Absolutely. And how you're saying, because we have all the greatest, and I don't want to say greatest, but all the biggest minds of antiquity, and maybe not minds either, but because there's some bad people included in that as well, that they were trying to tap into, you know, this idea of World War II being some maybe alchemical or occult war, that the elites, the point is that the elites are wanting to tap into whatever this is. And maybe that's what the whole, you have movies like Star Wars with, I call him Giorgio Fucus now, shout out to Gabe because he, we did a Star Wars decode, but the idea that there is something that you're able to tap into and use, but you can use it for whatever is your pleasure. You could use it for good or you could use it for evil. But the point is that we have the elites tapping into whatever this is. And we have the idea of the cross led you to this place in Peru. Can we talk about the caves a little bit? Because you talk about this place of refuge where you're able to go to avoid this catastrophe. But also I want to touch on, because I'm a big fan of Tracy Twyman's work, where what if it isn't just a physical place, Jay, and it's more like a hidden hyperspace kingdom, how Tracy was alluding to, that the elites are able to ascend to, right? This the Jacob's ladder, the third obscured pillar, the, you know, on the Masonic tracing boards. Is it a real place? Or is it a stargate that when you get there, you are able to dissolve to this other reality?
So what they do is they choose areas that have certain electromagnetic qualities. They like volcanic tunnels, for instance, because the lava has sealed the outside of the wall. So the minerals, the heavy crystallized minerals, are in a circle. So they're creating vortex hyperfields just on their own. And so they choose these areas. Vulcanelli means Vulcan Canelli. Mm. Canelli is tunnel in Italian and in Latin, and Vulcan is volcano. So his name means tunnel in the volcano. And a lot of the places that he mentions, like Le Puy in France, is a ancient volcanic site where you can actually walk down into the tunnels, as I have in Shasta and Mount Rainier. Okay.
Yes.
So, and these places are also known for what? UFOs, strange sightings, mm-hmm. weird places, underground cities, all this weird lore is always associated with these places because they're leak places in between the parallel plasma universes. And so that's what you want. You want to be able to go into these places. So it's both. It's a physical place that allows you to enter in to a portal or a transdimensional place that allows you to receive information that is not coming from a three-dimensional source, information that's vital to you. And if you don't, when you're being given that information, you better be paying attention. That's all I've got to say, because that's the most important information yes. that's going to be given. And these things are everywhere. I mean, you know, if you take a dimethyltryptamine in a lab and you turn off all the lights and you strike say you've got a pan of the powder of the dimethyltryptamine, and you turn off the light and you strike it, you get an electrical spark that flies. Because psychedelics allow you to see these other dimensions. They create a small portal hole in, not all psychedelics, but organic ones. And so, but even some are inorganic, like DMT. So I believe psychedelics play a very important part in alchemy in the past. I think there's many books which, you know, are definitely pointing towards some kind of psychedelic way to get trans dimensional information. And so,
like Dante's Inferno, I've heard Dante's Inferno is a hint at DMT.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think also the burning bush with Moses. I think a lot of this is just like, wow, this is like, you know, if you ever tripped out on on good psychedelics, you understand what they're really actually talking about. And, you know, I've gotten really good information from psychedelics, information that changed my life. I mean, really. And so I think all of these things are all part of it. And we're moving towards this collective point, you know, all the longitude lines on a globe are separated at the equator. But as they move towards the pole, they converge. And I think that's what we're doing. We're converging now into this one area where all the knowledge of all this different stuff, from music to math, to sacred geometry, to psychedelics, to astronomy, to astrology, is all converging into this one kind of group mind, which, you know, people like us are probably the front edge of it. And I had the, you know, the good graces to work at Gaia for 6 years, where I interviewed and talked to all these great minds. And I was able to, like, become one of the first people to actually create that convergence, but only because of, you know, luck of the draw, really. And so I think that's where we're headed right now. And I think that here's what I think, because this is like, alchemy has a sense of humor. That's all I can say. So as we converge towards all of this disparate knowledge becoming one, and we become very wise as a species, we're probably going to have a catastrophe. That's the way it goes. And I think we're headed towards a catastrophe. I don't believe it has anything to do with the Ukraine or anything like that. I think it's going to be a mental disaster brought on by the changing electromagnetic fields. You know, there's a very interesting book. I don't really want to tell people about it, but to make my point, I think it's called A Brief History of the Future. And it's written by one of Francois Mitterrand, former president of France, his top advisor. And you can get it on Amazon. And in the book, it was written in the late 70s, early 80s. He says in the book, the biggest problem the human race faces is stupid people. He's real blunt. You know, he's a French, you know, he's just blunt, right? It's stupid people. Stupid people screw up everything. How are we going to get rid of the stupid people? The only way we can get rid of the stupid people is we have to figure out some way, which is what the book's about. And in the book, he actually mentions as being one of the answers to eliminating stupid people. He doesn't really say how it's going to do it, but in retrospect now, here in late 2022, you have to wonder if we haven't just been through a psyop that's designed to eliminate stupid people. And so I think, again, there's some kind of weird thing going on right now that we don't see, that may be alchemists at work again.
Yeah, because if you look at the father of modern day toxicology, Daddy Paracelsus, I mean, he was the one that helped make this. So that's why I said at the beginning of the episode, it's the alchemist of antiquity that were using this stuff, and then it transformed, right? It goes underground for a little bit. It's kind of reemerging, but in the shadows, these, I call them the reptilian overlords, but these, the cabal at work, these dark forces, the archons, whatever you want to call them, they use this same technology against us, right in our faces. It's like, do as I say, but not as I do.
Okay, now wait a minute. It's not quite the same. What they do is they take the alchemical processes and they materialize it into technology. So it's not really the same.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a guy I know, he was building houses in Indonesia like 30 years ago. And he was American, right? He's just doing it for charity work. And every day he saw this woman, she'd walk by and she was sitting in this field and she would just, like, you know, be quiet in the field for a half hour. And one day he walked up to her and he said, what do you, every day I see you go at noon and you sit in the field for a half hour. What are you doing? She goes, oh, my husband is a construction worker, you know, 500 miles away. And so we talk. We every day at noon, he stops and sits down and I stop and sit down and we exchange information. And the guy's like, wow, that's pretty wild and crazy. So, you know, 10 years later, he's still building houses and he sees the lady, the same woman, now 10 years older, only now she's going to a phone booth every day at noon and talking on the phone for an hour. So one day he walks up to her and says, well, wait a minute. You used to go sit over in the field, you know, and be quiet, but now you're talking on the phone. What are you doing? And she goes, oh, I'm talking to my husband. He's working in construction. And he says, well, why are you talking on the phone? He says, well, it's a lot faster. So this is what technology does. It takes the same exact thing, right? And it kind of it turns it into archonic energy. And so we lose touch with it, which is why I love the Tartaria movement, because it's self-evident from looking at the architecture and from understanding it that these people were in touch with something far, far, far greater than what we're in touch with, and that they're able to heat their houses and probably read at night and everything without any worrying about fires, and because they're tapping into these larger sources, which are there just waiting for us. And we know that, you know, Nikola Tesla lived in Serbia, which is a huge Tartarian enclave, if you've ever been there. And he must have looked at the buildings and thought, what are these really about, right? And he built his towers and his energy transformation thing, because he was an alchemist too. And and I think we're headed towards this again, where my hope and dream is that we're going to tear down our cities and rebuild them in an alchemical way, in a positive way, where we don't have the negativity that we have in our cities now. And it's really about place. You know, place is seriously important, and everybody listening should be going out of their way to make the place they live into an alchemical vessel. And, you know, I do all sorts of things. I've got Oregon pyramids all over the place. I've got, you know, all sorts of things all the time going, because I just want to create a super positive place where I live, because I know that is going to have the greatest effect on me and my mental, physical, and spiritual health.
Yeah, so because
nature is everything. It's everything.
Yes.
Go ahead, Romy.
Oh, I was going to say, I saw that on your YouTube channel, you just had a show not too long ago, kind of where you were diving into Wilhelm Reich, who is just another one of those characters from the same exact time period that was busting parallels and like creating great new things, and yet again was taken out by, you know, however, whoever. But I wanted to ask you your opinion on, because we know that alchemists, right, that's where they created a lot of the fun stuff. They were able to work with the spirit of a lot of plants, and they understood plant medicine and plant magic and a lot of the things that are intertwined with nature. And the green language basically, in my opinion, is like the verbal communication style of what we consider the archetype of the green man. And the green man shows up on a lot of these buildings. But that's not the question. The question is this powder of projection, do you think that this supposed red, sometimes yellow, powder of projection is DMT, or it is a drug? It's something, it's an alchemically created substance to thus interact with the consciousness in a way so you can create alchemy and understand the wavelengths in between.
It's endogenous DMT. So endogenous means it comes from you. It comes from within, which is alchemical. So
yes.
So serotonin, which is emitted by the pineal gland, is one atom away from dimethyltryptamine. That's a natural producing psychedelic produced by your brain when you're dreaming and all of that. That's when the serotonin comes out. So serotonin's opposite is melatonin, which is, so serotonin is emitted when light hits your eyes. When you wake up in the morning and the light hits your eyes for the first time, your pineal gland begins emitting serotonin. You feel good. You know, it's a really great drug. It makes you feel good. The sunshine kind of gives you a little bit of a psychedelic feeling. And, you know, you wake up and you start, you know, working your day out, right? And as the light fades at night, the serotonin begins diminishing and the melatonin begins coming on. What is melatonin? Melatonin is it's the hormone that causes you to reverse aging. Okay. What is alchemy? Alchemy is enlightenment, spiritual enlightenment, and a long, healthy life. That's what it offers you. That's what it says you get if you're practicing. Okay. So,
yeah,
the alchemists have found a way, and the story of Jesus is about this, to activate the pineal gland, to activate the serotonin and melatonin and turn them into essentially super serotonin and super melatonin. And so what, and this is all of their practices from all over the world, they're the same practices. Okay. So what the alchemist does, he has a secret society of friends who will help him, and then he has to help them. And they have a chamber, a light, dark, a completely light free chamber.
Tomb of illumination.
The crypts under the cathedrals. It would be the king's chamber in the pyramid. And then they would go into the dark room, completely no light, not even a sliver. Okay. For 3 days, just like Jesus. Okay. And then they come out on the morning, and their alchemist friends take the practice is that you're placed into a casket, a light free casket. Okay. And your alchemist friends take you to the top of a hill or the top of the pyramid, somewhere where you got a good view of the morning light. You open up the casket. You're blindfolded, just like in Freemasonry. You're taken out. They take the blindfold off as soon as the sun starts hitting the horizon. And for the time that the sun rises, you stare into that sun. And, you know, you will, your knees will buckle. You'll be overloaded by a DMT experience that's endogenous. It is your own DMT experience. And then after 5 or 6 minutes of this, they put you back in the casket, take you back into the dark room where that. So 3 days in the dark created the first degree of super melatonin in your pineal gland. When you looked at the sun, that super melatonin was turned into super serotonin, which is a dimethyltryptamine endogenous experience. And then when they put you back in the room, that super serotonin turns into super melatonin, and you begin to regrow your nervous system, lose your teeth and regrow them, lose your hair and regrow your hair. Painful, long 40-day experience of the rejuvenation of the entire body. So you had the psychedelic spiritual experience of looking at the sun after 3 days of being in the dark, and then you have the rejuvenation experience of the living in the dark with the melatonin rejuvenating the body. So that's what they were doing. It's endogenous alchemy. It doesn't need to take any kind of thing. It's what the Taoists were doing. What's his name in Thailand is doing it right now. Montauk Chia is doing this. There's a dark room here in my hometown where they do it. The Peruvian, the Incas were doing it in the caves. It's one of the reasons why the Cross of Hende points at the Inca caves, because that's where they were doing their light dark work. The cathedrals were the same thing. The crypt was the dark room. They take them out into the morning light of the cathedral where the different color lights would hit the pineal gland, causing all sorts of different field effects, you might say. And that right there is the most important information I can give the world. And I hope that people will actually practice this. I really do.
Wow.
Okay. Wow.
So yeah, we're exposing esoteric and occulted secrets on this podcast, which is great. Straight from the man himself, Jay Widener. And yeah, it makes me think of maybe how they're trying to reproduce this with how I brought it up earlier, cinema, with these cinema magicians is what I call them, where they put you in these movie theaters, a dark place, and they flash a bunch of lights in front of you all at the same time, make you go through all these emotions all at the same time, to then
as a filmmaker, I can tell you that is super effective magic. And to use the sound and everything is like, it can transform you. And I'm about to go see Avatar 2, although I kind of don't want to, but I'm going to go see it anyway, just because I want to see what kind of tricks camera
for observation, you know, for observational science purposes.
Exactly. One of the things that blew my mind with that movie was, because I'm a big Avatar fan as well. One of the things that blew my mind with that movie, I still haven't watched it, is the fact that he said he took so long to record that movie because he didn't have the technology for it. Does that sound familiar at all? Because I know, Jay, you're real big into the moon landings.
The Kubrick.
Yeah. Well, I mean he was developing the technology. Have you seen the movie Avatar 2?
I haven't. No, I've seen the first one. I've been meaning to go see the second one, but I need to find a babysitter for 3.5 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
James Cameron is that he's
like, holy crap, who has 4 hours archetype to give to a movie these days, you know? So no, you know, Avatar 1 had a kind of an alchemical theme to it. About the earth revolting against these beings that were coming in to destroy it. And even the substance that they were mining had, you know, anti-gravity force to it and everything. So Avatar was actually a pretty interesting movie, actually. Kind of dumb.
The tree as well.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, it's Kabbalistic. And yeah, like characters in Hollywood like James Cameron, where I don't know if there's like they're getting picked and selected because of their names, or if there's like a cosmic duty that you fill, because maybe choosing a name, or when you get brought into this world in your initiatory process through your parents and that alchemical marriage, is kind of setting you on a path. But, you know, JC, every time you kind of see that, you know, in popularity, you're like, oh, you know, you're fulfilling some sort of like prophetic type of archetype. And I was thinking that about your partner that you worked with, Vincent Bridges, because, you know, like his last name was Bridges and, you know, your last name is Widener. It's like a wider perspective, you know, and the bridges are being connected and crossed. And, you know, I didn't know if it's okay to bring him up, because I know he's your friend and, you know, and he worked with you on this book, but, you know, what a great partner to have worked with, you know, great man, huh?
Yeah. And also the Cross of Hende is at St. Vincent's Church in Hende, which, you know, I went there long before I met Vincent. So it was just like, whoa, you know, and, no, Vincent was like, I remember the night. It was like, I think it was Halloween night, 1996. And I was at my house up in Nederland, Colorado at 9,000 feet, and there was a snowstorm. And he had bought a bottle of brandy, and I had a fire going. And he's like, well, what are you working on? You know, I didn't know who he was. Dan Winter had introduced me. And
you were friends with Dan before you were friends with Vincent?
Yeah. Dan actually worked at Gaia with me. And then I told him, I didn't want to tell anybody because, you know, he's trying to keep my work a secret. And then he started talking about the Kabbalah and the Tree of Life. And I realized that the Cross of Hende actually looked a little bit like the diagrams he was showing me. And then I just opened up and I showed him, spent like 2 hours showing all my work. And he was like, he's over and over, he's going, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit. Right. And then I got done. And because I was not as astute in occult studies as Vincent. So I was really coming at it from more of a, you know, a puzzle, trying to solve a puzzle. Mm-hmm. And I got done and he kind of sat back and he took a big drink of brandy and he looked at me and said, do you realize what you just did? I was like, what? And he goes, you just connected alchemy with the eschatology. I went, I did?
You know? I would have loved to get to meet him and maybe have him on an episode. I mean, you know, rest in peace.
He did. Rest in peace. He was awesome. He brought all of that knowledge of the history. That's all him. You know, that was all him. It was like, it would be like a high school team, you know, getting like the best pro football player right on the team. Yep. And I was like, whoa. And he started mowing over me. At first, I was a little angry about it because he was mowing over me. But then I realized, nope, just let him go. Just let him go. Yep, He's going to get it all. And he busted his ass. And thank you, Vincent. You know, I don't get many chances to thank you for the work that you contributed to the Henday material. But you were an awesome guy. And, you know, he died, by the way. He was running the Alchemical Museum in Prague the last 3 years of his life. And he died.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever been there, but they have these stairs, you know, hundreds of stairs going up. He died going up those stairs.
Really? Yeah, because he was an Edward Kelly esotericist. I mean, one of the leading names in that. And I came through his information doing research on John Dee and, you know, the angel Enochian magic and all that stuff. And that's how I stumbled across this book. And I had told, Rudolph II, I have told Romy here about Vincent. He was blown away. And then he's like, oh, dude, check this book out. And it was you with Vincent. I was like, oh, man. So that's how I got introduced to this. And Jay, this has been great, man. I really love this. I enjoyed our conversation. Is there anything, any closing thoughts that you want to leave with the listeners before we get out of here, as far as what they can do or what's to come next, or what can they do in their lives to I don't know, step outside and maybe not get sucked into this alchemical storm that's going on right now and with life?
I would say just remember and realize that you are in control of your reality, and don't ever let anyone ever tell you that you're not. And I am living proof that this is so. I made it a scientific experiment to see if I could do what I wanted to do, and I did, and you can too. You just have to concentrate. You need discipline, 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 discipline. That's what you need. You need to wake up every day and plan your day and devote your life to the seeking of knowledge and the spread of knowledge in a benevolent way, and don't ask for money, and you will be very happy with the results.
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Jay, for coming on. I would love to have you back on. I know you said that everybody wants to talk to you about Kubrick, but I would like to talk to you about Kubrick and your work and your documentaries. I know you have a few. Can you plug your stuff where people can find you? I know you have a great YouTube channel. And do you have any upcoming projects that you want to plug for the people listening so they can check those out? Your website or anything?
I have projects, but I can't talk about them. But you can go to my YouTube, Reality Check. Just type in my name and Reality Check. Also, I have jwidener.com and my films. I have about 25 films that are on Gaia.com and Amazon. And you can check those out, Healing the Luminous Body and Alex Gray and all the great teachers of the last few years I've done films with. And thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Absolutely, Jay. Anytime. This is an honor. And thank you so much again.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.